Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is our Salute to Christy show because we like Christy because Christy likes most of the stuff we put on our Facebook page.
Now, Christy, there's a lot of ways we could go with this, but I think we mean the one.
There is one Christy, if you look on Health Matters Facebook page.
Which we'll get to in a minute. We'll get to it in a minute.
Right, right. And we thought it was time to thank her. She has bent the show. She has changed the show because the way I look at it, if I post something on Facebook and she doesn't like it, then that's pretty clear that was a subpar post.
Right.
And so she has, by liking things, she's actually maybe more self-conscious, but that's the kind of person I am, and there's no surprise there, I guess.
And, you know, we like likes.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. We're bribing people right now. You give us a bunch of likes, send us to your friends, get a bunch of viewers.
You can jerk us around like a puppet on a string.
And we will, in fact, honor you. We will honor you.
So thanks to Christy for liking a lot of our Facebook posts with me from the University of Kentucky to talk about our web presence, including our Facebook page. Manager of Communications Infrastructure, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio that shows Christy. We have audio as well. WMKY.org. That's right, WMKY.org. That's Moorhead State Public Radio's website. Navigate over to Health Matters. Look at the list of shows. Read the little summary. See which one you want to listen to. Click on the link. You can listen to it right then. You can download it, listen to it later. If you know what a podcast is, you can sign up for the podcast and have Health Matters delivered to you roughly 4 days after it airs. So we air first time on Saturday morning, sometime on Tuesday. You'll usually have that podcast delivered to you automagically. So certainly, WMKY.org is where you want to go for the audio information. Or you could jump over to Facebook, facebook.com/HM Radio Show. Join Christy. Be a liker, right? What you'll see is we'll definitely, from time to time, post information that's both sometimes on the show, sometimes it's not on the show. It's just timely. We certainly look at the feedback. We certainly look at the comments. Every once in a while, we leave our own thoughts on there, although that doesn't happen too often. Usually it's in reference to some piece of news media that's, or some news item that's come across the desk and needs to be shared with our friends. We would certainly encourage you to be a part, interact with Health Matters. Go to facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, Stop Bang Sleep Questionnaire.
Whoa. Whoa.
I know.
Stop Bang. That's one word.
It is one word. Stop Bang stands for, as you might imagine, STOPBANG. Those are the questions that you ask to determine whether or not a person has sleep apnea.
Have we not taken acronyms a little too far?
Well, you got to admit, a Stop Bang sleep questionnaire doesn't sound quite congruous, is the word I would use.
Can't we come up with some other description that involves sleeping?
Yeah, you would think a snooze roll or something like that.
Stop, bang. If you hear a gunshot, don't you wake up?
Let me say, once you spell out stop, you've got B-A-N-G, and you put that together, stop,
true.
You've got nothing left except bang, but that's the sleep questionnaire. Their motto, you snooze, you win. These are the questions in the Stop, Bang. Questionnaire. You like this. This is going to be your next project. Is going to be the Stop Bang project.
Hey, if Sheldon Cooper on Big Bang Theory can say bazinga,
yeah,
I'm going with Stop Bang.
Okay. The S in Stop Bang stands for snoring. Do you snore loudly? This is the hallmark
wait a minute.
Sleep apnea.
Tony, if nobody ever said a word, would you ever be able to know that you snore? Do you record yourself sleeping?
Do you snore loud enough to be heard through closed doors, or your bed partner, assuming you have one, elbows you for snoring at night?
Yeah. Shouldn't that say, has anybody ever knocked on your door and said you're snoring through the door?
Yeah. Fair enough. Do you snore loudly? That's the S. T, tired. Do you feel tired, fatigued, or sleepy during the daytime, falling asleep during driving or while talking to someone?
I got two out. I'm batting 1,000 so far.
All right. Observed. Has anyone observed you? That's the O. Stop breathing or choking or gasping during your sleep.
Did they have their hands around my neck?
Well, this one, I got to tell you, I have people come in the clinic. You know, the spouse comes in and says, I thought he was dying. Or I thought she was dying. They're terrified, and they slap or actually they hit the person that's sleeping to try to get them to wake up. They're worried they will not wake up. And then the P of stop, and this is, I think, is cheating, pressure. Are you treated for high blood pressure? Now, it seems like it should be an H, but Stobang just isn't. doesn't carry the punch that Stop Bang does. So the question, do you snore? Are you tired? Have you been observed to stop breathing while sleeping? And are you treated for pressure, high blood pressure? We'll get to Bang, our next fractional portion. Our sponsor, the Stop Bang questionnaire for sleep apnea.
The P, that one's going to be, that's a stretch.
Pressure, you don't like that. I didn't either. I didn't like the whole thing. Like I said, a Stop Bang questionnaire, it certainly gets your attention. But this is available online if you want to check your score. The points we're making are these are the signs. These are the findings in a person who has sleep apnea. So if you're wondering about sleep apnea, stay tuned and we'll give you the second half and our second fractional portion. Rick, it's time to talk about 3D printing.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I thought you would like that.
All I want for Christmas is a 3D printer.
The October 5th journal Pediatrics described 3D printing to safeguard a baby before birth. This was kind of cool. This is a 20-year-old woman, 30 weeks into her pregnancy, got an ultrasound. There was a large mass on the face of the fetus, of the baby, right, late in pregnancy. They were worried that it might block the baby's airway. They didn't know exactly what it was, but they were worried. Obviously in the womb, right, the baby's getting its nourishment, its oxygen from the placenta. Once it comes out and draws that first breath, could it in fact draw that first breath, or is this baby going to have to be emergently resuscitated or C-sectioned or so forth? They didn't know. They did an ultrasound, not enough information there. They did an MRI, which you can do safely, and they still couldn't tell about that. So they did then a high-density MRI, and they built a 3D model of the baby's face.
Right.
And using that 3D model, they were able to identify the abnormalities, and they noted that the airway in the 3D model would be satisfactory for breathing, so they did not need to intervene on this baby. And they did that by printing, basically reprinting in 3D from the MRI scan, the baby's face.
So now, Tony, you know where this is. I mean, at what point is this a function or an add-on cost that's not covered by insurance, but you're able to basically buy a replica
of your baby?
Of your baby.
I mean, sure, if you want a blurry ultrasound with a smiley face on it, that's one thing. But how about a 3D sculpture of your unborn
baby?
There it is.
I think the physics are on our side here, because I think, you know, ultrasound and MRI, neither of those use radiation. But still, you know, I can see people doing this late term, early term. I mean, I can see, you know, buying a package and having three or four over the course of 9 months. This 3D printing thing in the medical environment, while it's going to be wonderful for medical applications and medical research and medical diagnosis, it's going to have some crazy stuff too.
That's the thing. I show you this. This
think about a broken
bone on this baby, and the first thing you think of is technology run amok. I am disappointed in you because I consider you Mr. Technology, and you immediately went to the dark side on this.
Well, no, I didn't. I mean, it's easy to do on this because everybody has this visualization. I mean, I've seen some of the 3D modeling that you can do, and some of these ultrasounds are extremely high definition, and the three dimensions is just amazing on the pictures. I can only imagine converting that into an actual printable, you know, thing. But I do think that, you know, 3D printing is really going to revolutionize more than just, it's going to change some of the way we look at medicine. It's just right. It's just amazing how they can do that.
Well, it sort of hits you then. Right now we're taking pictures. Again, we take two-dimensional pictures. We're recording them electronically. We've gotten rid of film. I think the iPhone 6 now has, apparently you can have some video component so that your pictures will move or wave or something like that, sort of like Harry Potter portraits do. And then the next step, obviously, is, well, 3D. And then could you, in fact, create a 3D moving a little image of your...
Well, you can already... They already have... Many of the 3D printers are paired with a 3D scanner as well. You can actually take your... I'm sitting here looking at your drink bottle. You could actually set that on the 3D scanner. The scanner would then detect its exact size, all the, you know, the moldings in it, all the, you know, anything that's a groove or whatever, create a replica of it, and literally then you could print out that bottle.
Now, what if I took a picture of my wife?
I'm ashamed to say that if you can't peruse the internet without coming across some really bad stuff. And while you're doing some, I've done lots of research on 3D printers, 3D modeling. You know, I'm fascinated with some of this technology and I want to know more about it. And then you occasionally run across the dark areas. Like you said, why did I go to the dark? I mean, occasionally you see that. Yes, you could print off, you could make it regular or bobblehead. Your choice.
Gotcha.
But now, yes, you can do that.
So, and if I took a picture of her standing in front of the White House, I could print her and the White House.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, it wouldn't be to scale, of course, but you know, you can certainly print, and it probably would all be one color, white, you know, depending on, you know, how you chose to print that, you'd probably, you know, have to do some painting. But
ooh,
they
like a model. I used to put together models.
Exactly. I mean, exactly.
Do you ever wonder, did you put together model cars?
Yes.
Do you ever wonder what happened to all those models? You don't see them in the flea markets or anywhere. None of those model cars apparently survived.
No.
I wonder what happened to all those model cars. I myself put together a model of a pirate ship. I remember that.
I have two remote control airplanes that are hanging up in my garage. Does that count?
Did you put them together yourself?
Yes.
Using contact cement and put the tab into the hole and cement them together and hold them for 30 seconds until
they're
your finger
stuck. They're a little bigger than that, but
and
yes.
You put decals on them afterwards?
Well, I put the film on them for the, yeah, yes, yes.
See, now you're making things up. The point is,
no, I'm
where
not
did
making
all those models go? I wonder, and perhaps if we get a 3D printer, then obviously doing jigsaw puzzles and puzzle models is going to be a lot easier once you get a 3D printer. You can cut that thing up, right?
3D printers are going to change lots of things. Now, right now in a home, they're still very much a novelty. I was joking with somebody the other day, and I told somebody, all I want for Christmas is a 3D printer. And they said, well, my goodness, what are you going to do with that? And I said, I'm going to print toothpicks. And they said, why on earth would you do that? And I said, because I can. So I mean, you know, granted, there's not a ton of uses. Now, I know a guy, really. He owns one, had one for a year and a half in his residential, you know, his home, and he's printed off some really cool things, some really crazy things. He's, you know, found, you know, printed things that ended up being toys for his kids. I mean, just a whole host of things. But anyway, the medical, back to the ultrasound, the 3D modeling is just going to be, you're going to see it just boom in the next 5 years.
This baby was saved some unnecessary procedures because they were able to ascertain that, in fact, the child's airway would be plenty enough for a natural birth.
Tony, think the same thing. We can do that same 3D imaging of your heart.
Yeah.
So we can print you off a replica of your heart.
And at some point, when I come in with my heart attack, you can print off replacement tissue. That's
coming.
The promise.
You know,
but not here yet.
It's funny. We're printing off things as small as tissue or things as live as tissue. We're printing things as large as, if you want to do a Google search, just go out and search 3D printed houses. You can actually have both a house that's printed from the ground up, or it's printed, parts of it are printed in a factory and then actually shipped to the site and hooked together.
You know what's going to bother me with that? Because we have a printer in our office, and I'm going to be halfway through printing my house, and somebody else is going to put a rush job through, and all of a sudden, in the middle of my house is something that I didn't want to print.
Get a smaller house.
Because that happens the whole
time.
Get
a smaller house.
That really annoys me. Really, really annoys
me. You know what annoys me? Not having a 3D printer. I want one. I want one bad.
Please, someone donate a 3D printer to Rick. We're going to take a break to give you a chance to think about perhaps making a small contribution to my co-host. Meanwhile, grab something refreshing and come back for our second fractional portion. More fascinating information about dog scans in our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is our Salute to Christy show. Thanks again to Christy, who likes and upvotes, I guess you call it, some
she
of our posts.
She just likes, that's all.
Yeah.
She likes.
And we appreciate that. We think that's it does influence your behavior after a while. I pore over the ones that she did not like, trying to figure out what would it take to make Christy like this particular post. Our sponsor for the second time, the Stop Bang Questionnaire.
Stop.
Bang. It turned out really well, I think. This is what happens after you've been together for over 10 years.
Sounds like a police altercation.
It really
Stop!
Does.
Bang!
All right, these are the questions you ask to determine whether or not you have obstructive sleep apnea. And again, the Stop Bang questionnaire, you can access this on the internet and total up your risk and your total points. Snoring. Do you snore loudly? Tired. Do you feel tired, fatigued, or sleepy during the daytime? Observed. Has anyone observed you stop breathing or gasping during your sleep? Pressure. Are you treated for high blood pressure? Now we're up to bang. Bang. The B is body mass index. Is your body mass index more than 35? That is in the morbid obesity category. Again, normal between 25 and 30, and above 35, a pretty hefty fellow, we would say that. A is age older than 50. I would meet that criteria. Rick still claims that he would not.
I would not.
N is neck size.
And I have
size.
The driver's license to prove it.
N is the neck size. For a male, is your shirt collar 17 inches or larger? For a female, is your shirt collar 16 inches or larger? And then finally, gender, male, That's the G, is are you a male? I am a male, over age 50. Neck size is tricky because I like big neck shirts. I do not like to have a very tight shirt collar. I keep mine very loose.
Well, that's my excuse, too.
But I do wear a 17-inch collar, although I don't. I can get by with smaller ones. They annoy me.
See, I do 18, but that's because I like all that extra room.
Body mass index,
you believe that,
35,
right?
And then the stop snoring, tired, observed to stop breathing during sleep, and treated for high blood pressure. Those are your risk factors. So if you or someone you love is wondering about obstructive sleep apnea, think about these questions, and you may want to take the stop bang test on the internet. Just search that, and you will find numerous risk calculators from the stop bang sleep apnea test index. Well, we mentioned in our previous fractional portion that we're talking about dog scans, and I thought this was pretty darn cool. It starts off with a story, as many featured articles do. This came from Medscape. Talks about the 12-year-old twins, Jade and Brooke Boardman of Cambridge, Ontario, diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes means that they have to have insulin to survive, that if they don't, they would rapidly go into a coma. The problem is they are not aware when their sugar gets low. They are 12 years old. They cannot sense when their sugar gets low. They sleep so soundly. Their father and their mother, both of them have full-time jobs. They had to sleep in shifts for the first 17 years. One of them had to stay awake constantly to monitor the girls, looking for sweating, looking for signs that the sugar might go low. Enter Nettie. Nettie is a yellow Labrador retriever, a glucose alert dog. She can smell some chemical changes on these girls, meaning their blood sugar has dropped low. First glucose alert dogs in Canada graduated in 2013. If their sugar gets below 80, and that's still the low side of the normal range, this dog can smell it, and she can either wake the child, wake the parents, or she can go fetch a sugar kit, and I assume she wakes everybody up and then runs and gets the sugar kit. 3 days after she moved in, she started nudging the father at 3 a.m. They had tested the girls earlier. They were fine. He grabbed a kit anyway. When he tested, Jade was down to 58. Nettie has alerted the family 12 times since she moved in. I think that was in 2013. Alerted the family 12 times, every time with accuracy. There are some other dogs that can both alert from low glucose and high glucose. Cost for training around $35,000. The U.S., it's called Dogs for Diabetic, D4D, started in 2004. Client pays only $150 for the dogs, and they typically work until they're 10 or 12 years old. Dogs for Diabetics in the U.S. placed about 150 dogs in the past 11 years. Accuracy record 80% to 90% for detecting blood glucose deviations. Families train with the dogs over 12 weekends, and then they get the dog. England, Wales, and Scotland have a list waiting up to 3 years. Canada, not quite as far advanced so this is the U.S., but there are only a few dogs available. And I will tell you, Rick, I actually, at the free clinic, I serve the function of a glucose dog.
Really?
Yeah, it turns out when you have a high sugar, you get a very distinctive fruity smell to your breath if you are a type 1 diabetic. It smells sort of like a beech nut chewing gum, if you remember the way they smell.
Right.
And it's really unmistakable. Once you smell that, we always have the medical students take a whiff because it permeates the room. I was examining a young man. He was heavily into Mountain Dew. He would go 2 to 3 liters a day of Mountain Dew, not diet, but the full sugar Mountain Dew, and he knew his sugar was high because his girlfriend was a diabetic. He had tested it, and he presented. He was worried about the fact he might be developing diabetes. I examined him, and he had that fruity odor, and I actually sent him to the emergency room. So that is an unmistakable smell. You don't need a dog for that. That's something we commonly do in the emergency room. I cannot smell low blood sugar. I have no sense of that smell, but apparently these dogs can smell something, I suspect on the breath of a person, when their sugar starts to drop low.
Yeah, you have to wonder how they do that because, you know, I know you see more and more, you know, diabetic service dogs, and it's funny because they look like the household pet a lot of times. You know, they're the little smaller, you know, putting them in your purse kind of dogs. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. These dogs, again, they're various breeds. They are Labs, Golden Retrievers, and crosses of those two breeds. That's the ones that they most commonly use. And the thing is, you know, if these dogs can, again, if you think about, you would think a bloodhound.
Right.
If I were going to get a glucose alert dog, I would or a diabetes alert dog, I would think first of a bloodhound. But I do know that golden retrievers are pretty darn friendly dogs, and they worry a lot.
Well, I don't want you to you don't want the bloodhound to start, you know, sounding off with his howl, you know, every time, you know.
Maybe that's it. Maybe the Labrador and the golden retrievers, they at least
less noisy.
And they know what to do.
Right.
And they actually do something, whereas I don't know. I've never had a bloodhound. I've had golden retrievers. I have been around labs. I've not had a lab. You've had a lab.
I've had a lab. They're wonderful.
Yeah. But I don't know what a bloodhound is like as a pet. I have no idea whether they would be good with children or not.
I don't know.
Anyway, perhaps someone can write us about that, because we are curious about it. Why not use bloodhounds? But the truth of the matter is, certainly some extreme forms of high glucose, even I can smell.
So I'm going to challenge you on something, Tony.
All right.
So in the ADA, right, there's definition of service animals. What two animals does the ADA recognize, recognize as potentially being a service animal?
Americans with Disabilities Act.
Correct.
ADA. And one of them's got
to be... So one we've talked about.
Yeah. I mean...
Dogs.
Dogs. And they
so
do.
I want you to guess the other one.
The other service animal. My first thought would be horses.
Miniature horses. That's
okay.
Correct.
Wow.
You did good.
I got lucky. And what do you know about miniature horses? Because I did not know this.
Well, there aren't any in Kentucky. I know that. And I think there's only one state that actually has one that's actually in service. But I think it's interesting. You know, dogs, you know, and as much as we love our pets, we know their mortality is a lot shorter than ours. And they tend to last anywhere between 7 and 11 years. And the actual time they perform as a service dog is less than that. Right. So they're in constantly, they don't give you a long, you're constantly going through service animals throughout your whole life. And so a horse, on the other hand, lives how long?
Oh, they can live 20s easily.
Or 40. I mean, some of them can get into the 40s, but they typically can get 20 to 25 years of service out of a miniature horse.
I would not want a miniature diabetes horse in my children's bedroom.
I don't disagree with you, and I'm only regurgitating some training that I got as part of being a supervisor.
Okay.
So
wait, you're saying as a supervisor, if one of your employees brings a horse into...
And says it's a service animal, I have to
You have to make accommodations for a horse in... I'm really liking this. So, keep in mind...
No, it has to be a miniature horse.
I would not expect you to make accommodations at UK's computing center for a full-size horse. That would be ridiculous. You would have to certainly... No one would expect you to make accommodations for anything more than a miniature horse next in your employee's cubicle.
Yes.
I am going to develop some type of chronic condition that needs a miniature horse.
You are
going to
make the newspaper. I promise you.
There are none in Kentucky. This is pretty sweet.
And I'm not sure if that particular service animals, from what I remember, don't necessarily have to. I don't think they have to be registered with the ADA. I don't think there's anything that they have to do. You have to do to make a service animal be a service animal.
Well, you know, octopuses are really intelligent.
But they're not on the list.
I know.
The ADA does, in fact, recognize breeds. And I'm, you know, you can't have a service pig.
Dang it.
You know, so, you know, you can't have it. I'm sorry. But I think going back to my training, it's been a little while since I had that training, but I'm pretty sure the two were...
You actually took your supervisor training that seriously. You thought, oh my gosh, I need to make plans for miniature horses at the workplace.
The American Disabilities Act is an important act. It's something we should all take serious.
We absolutely
And clearly you're not here.
No, now wait a second. Now you're painting me in a corner. But let me point out that, as you said, I had never even heard of service miniature horses
right.
in the state of Kentucky.
There are none. There are none. That's
there
why
are
you
none.
Haven't heard.
And right. so, I frankly, any training that involves something that's not happening is something that I file away.
Right.
I would certainly be able to look that up, but I would not suggest to my employees, what you need is a miniature horse to help you with your disability.
I'm telling you, a long time ago, you taught me some things about how to give a presentation, and one of them was to every once in a while make people laugh or to get something that gets their attention and keeps them awake, keeps the blood flowing.
Well, you got me.
During that particular segment of that training, that instructor had my attention. Let's put it that way.
Okay. So we've got our diabetes dogs. And again, I qualify.
And Christy, we hope you like that.
As a very inefficient diabetes dog. And the other thing you mentioned, these diabetes dogs, they mentioned the service life is 8 to 12 years. What you don't want to find out is that your service diabetic dog has quit on you.
Right.
That's bad.
I'm
news.
Out.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't answer the call.
Or better
anymore.
Yet, what if it decides to quit sniffing and just doesn't alert?
So that's the point. You think, well, I guess the warranty expired on the service.
Do you do like some quality control test? Every once in a while, you know, you give them the smell they need to smell, or you know,
refresher course.
Well, I just a quality control check.
Yeah. Well, that's isn't that the problem with working with animals? We've gone here from high-tech 3D printing all the way down to...
But that's the kind of show we are.
Yeah. I really think...
The truth is, you intended us to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Americans can't stand soccer because it doesn't have instant replay. And I think in the same way, we are going to have problems with service animals, especially these diabetic dogs.
You don't think a miniature horse is going to be welcome
at the workplace? Well, I agree that it might, but I think just the variations in dealing with animals are just going to drive us nuts because we can't... Who can we hold accountable if the horse doesn't do its job? This is a tricky thing.
This is my service snake.
I like an octopus. They're bright. They're inquisitive. They could do the job, I think. Next up, hearing trouble. Hearing trouble. I thought this was pretty interesting.
I'm not going to go where you think I'm going to go. I'm not going to give you that dumb.
This was back in September. It's the AMA Journal of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery. This was a medical student, actually, and also at Johns Hopkins. Johns Hopkins seems to publish the interesting stuff this fall. Noted that 2/3 of adults over 70 experience hearing impairment. This is a very common condition in elderly people. They looked at about 1,700 adults from a nationally representative survey back in 2005, repeated in 2010, and they looked at death records at the end of 2011, and the survey included questions about hearing. The people in the two surveys, again, 1,700 people, all over age 70, had undergone hearing testing, and if you use the World Health Organization criteria to define hearing impairment, they found that people with moderate or severe hearing impairment had a 54% greater risk of dying during the study than those with normal hearing. Mild impairment, 27% increased risk. They adjusted for cardiovascular risk factors. Maybe sick people lose their hearing, but they looked at education. They still could not find, they did find that impaired hearing actually increased your risk of dying. The worse the patient's hearing loss, the greater the risk of death. This is, and again, I don't want to make people with hearing aids feel bad. That's not the point here. It may be that diseases that have an impact on your overall health, among other things, impact your hearing. So if you have a bunch of people with hearing aids, half of them played in a high school rock and roll band, and the other half have some serious underlying chronic disease, and those are the people you worry about. It may be that having decreased hearing causes increased risk of dying. Maybe you don't understand the directions as well on taking your medicines. Maybe you're not able to hear traffic noise. Maybe you're not able to hear your spouse nag at you or telling you to watch out or people telling you to duck. That sort of thing is very useful to know. Or, like I said, maybe the diseases cause the hearing loss, but for whatever reason, there is a relationship. There is a correlation, and that's as far as we can go with that study.
And that's as far as we're going to go with that segment.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, you could, I think there are a lot of reasons to protect your hearing. I don't think that this changes my approach to protecting my hearing. If you cannot hear a normal conversation wherever you are, it's too loud. And if you have to raise your voice in order to be heard, that's too loud. You ought to be wearing ear protection if you're exposed to that for any length of time.
Yeah.
Pure and simple.
I mean, you know, I think the sad thing here is I think, you know, people probably don't do enough to keep their hearing protected throughout their young life. And I know I was guilty, you know, rock music, listening to headphones. Back when we were fairly young, you know, you still had boom boxes, which is something now. I think a boom box now, people would see it as being completely insensitive. And I mean, how many times have in the last 3 years have you walked through a public place and saw somebody playing music actually where you could hear it?
That's a good point. And the boom boxes, if I recall, a boom box you carried on your shoulder,
big shoulder.
The speakers faced you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that you had a speaker in your ears.
Right. Right. And so, or you'd set it down and just crank it up, and then the whole world had to listen to how loud it was. Now we kill our ears one person at a time.
Yeah.
Now we do it with headphones, and basically you can't walk through an airport terminal without seeing, you know, probably 3 out of every 4 people have headphones on.
Now the problem is you can hear their music from their headphones.
If you're getting a quiet place, a lot of times you can, and that's, you know.
And that's actually, interesting enough, that's felt to be a higher risk than the boombox.
Right.
Having that and your headphones, this is a concern. So this generation, although they have forsaken boomboxes, they in fact with their earplugs may even be worse. Now I'm going to ask our radio producer, Hunter Reese, I'm going to ask him a question on the air right now. Hunter, do you know what the word funky, if someone said you are funky, do you know what that would mean? How would you feel if someone called you funky? Does that mean something to you?
I guess it would either mean that I stink or...
That's all we need. Hunter's generation says the word funky means that I have an odor. What I'm saying, Rick, is when you said boombox, I actually thought about this the other night. I'm not sure, frankly, that the word funky, you know, it is no longer used.
Rarely.
Yeah, people are not funky. I mean, people are still ritzy. If you describe something as ritzy, people would still know about that, but they don't know what funky is. That word died.
Well, it's those same people don't know who Rick James is. I mean, you know, that he was the super freak. You know, he was definitely...
But now freaky, people would understand.
Yeah, but,
getting freaky.
But his music was funky.
His music was funky.
So, yeah. So, see, I'm saying,
okay.
He's kind of the king of that whole stuff. So, if you don't know that, you don't know Rick James.
You don't know.
Rest his soul. He's been dead a few years.
I just wondered, and thanks, Hunter. I appreciate the Hunter actually went on there. I didn't have a mic, but that's okay. And said that funky would probably mean having an abnormal smell. And I understand that because, like I said, this is a word that simply died. I spent most of my high school years trying to be funky.
Yeah.
I was hoping,
and instead, that's just the way you dance.
I was kind of hoping that I could be, in fact, a funky jive turkey, and that is no longer my goal.
You know, and I suspect the word died for several reasons. It's too close to other things that you have to be very careful that you don't have a slip up. And so anyway, I think, you know, it's not a good word.
59 seconds. Let me just tell you, the editorial board, New York Times, the World Health Organization published a paper that processed meats like bacon, ham, and hot dogs are a cause of colon cancer and conceivably of stomach cancer. That link has not been pinned down quite as much. Again, these processed meats, if you cure them, smoke them, use other methods for preserving them, that generates chemicals that are carcinogens. Red meats like beef and pork, probably a cause of colorectal cancer, possibly a cause of pancreatic cancer. Now, here's the thing. I want to put these numbers out there for you to think about during the break. Tobacco smoking causes 1 million cancer deaths a year worldwide. Here in the state of Kentucky, estimated 7,700 deaths every year due to tobacco smoking. Alcohol, 600,000, about over 500,000 annual cancer deaths. Diets high in processed meat around the world, 34,000 cancer deaths.
Wow.
So, yes, it is a carcinogen. No, it is not the carcinogen we should be worrying about here in Kentucky. We should worry about taking a break. Why don't you take one and come back for our third and final fractional portion? You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is our Salute to Christy show. Christy,
we salute you.
We do, and we appreciate all of the likes that you have littered on our Facebook page.
Not littered.
And we strive to understand why some of our posts do not get a like, and we will try to do better in the future, we promise. For the final time, the sponsor, the Stop Bang Questionnaire. Rick now is working on the Stop Bang program.
I'm really worried virus. Because most of those letters I have some firsthand experience with.
Following questions to see if you are at risk for obstructive sleep apnea, a condition where your tongue and the tissues of your mouth flop backwards and block off your airway when you sleep. If you snore loud enough to be heard through closed doors, or your bed partner elbows you for snoring at night. Now, my bed partner elbows me all the time. I don't think she has any particular reason. She just doesn't like me after a certain hour of night. But that's my problem, and certainly not to be made public on a radio show. We'll probably edit this section out.
No. Hunter, you leave that in.
T, do you feel tired? Do you often feel tired, fatigued, or sleepy during the daytime, falling asleep during driving, or when talking to someone? O, observed. Has anyone observed you stop breathing? Now, keep in mind, if you have obstructive sleep apnea, if someone has observed you stop breathing, well, that sort of means you've probably got it. I think that's a very, very high risk factor, the O in stop. P is for pressure. We don't like that, but that's what they said. Are you being treated for high blood pressure? Now, we think that obstructive sleep apnea may lead to a higher blood pressure by disrupting your circadian rhythms. It is also possible that high blood pressure in some way might lead to higher risk of obstructive sleep apnea. Certainly, the risk factors, obesity particularly, for high blood pressure and sleep apnea are similar. Body mass index is B. Body mass index more than 35, and that would put you in the severely obese category. Age older than 50 is A, and neck size for a male shirt collar size greater than 17 inches, for a female shirt collar size greater than 16 inches, a large neck size, a very thick neck is one of the characteristics of people with a higher risk of obstructive sleep apnea. And then finally, gender male. Males have a much higher risk of obstructive sleep apnea than females do, although I know I have a number of current and former patients who have obstructive sleep apnea who are, in fact, females. That's our sponsor, the Stop Bang Sleep Questionnaire, reminding you, you snooze, you win. If you can sleep and continue to breathe throughout the night, you are a winner in our book. This one came from the journal Pain, not a journal I read regularly, and it is odd that the journal
Pain... You don't read about pain often?
That's right. You think about it. Pain comes once a month. Doesn't sound like a fun journal to read. It was published October 23. They applied heat to the skin of 17 people with arthritis. This is a really interesting study. They put heat, a heat probe, to the skin of 17 people with arthritis and 9 people without arthritis, and they found the people with arthritis were better able to tolerate the pain associated with heat being applied to their skin. They went back and also did a PET scan and found that those arthritis people had more opiate receptors in their brain. And they figured that is an adaptive response. Those extra receptors take advantage of your body's own opioids that it makes, and that helps them to cope better with chronic pain. So again, we have a people who experience chronic pain with arthritis. It's only 17. It's not a lot of people. 9 people without arthritis. They were able to tolerate an induced pain better, and they had more of these receptors on PET scans. They had more receptors in the brain. Mechanisms of these adaptive changes are unknown. We can understand if we can figure out how to enhance this, we may find a way of naturally dealing with pain, at least to reduce the severity by increasing these receptors. It changes the way we think about chronic pain. Generally, a negative and fatalistic view of chronic pain. Pain makes you weak. Pain makes you worse. No one wants pain. In fact, pain induces some responses that help you if you have an acute pain. And you know, Rick, I have known or suspected this for a long time. I see these professional football players.
Okay.
They get absolutely walloped in a way that would put me to bed for at least a week.
Right.
They get sore. They do ice baths, which I could not stand to do. You've seen that picture of Peyton Manning.
Sure.
Sitting in an ice bath.
Right.
I could not do that.
You're not Peyton Manning.
No, and I have not had
If I paid you $50 million, could you do it?
I'm not sure. Honestly,
oh, come
I don't
on.
Know. Well, yeah, I mean, they do. You remember that ice bucket challenge? We would turn an ice bucket over our head, and we thought we were manly or brave for doing that. And there's Peyton sitting in a whole tub full of ice watching TV.
$50 million, I think I could do it.
You think so?
A year, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is that he is very used to physical discomfort.
Right.
And that's my point. I think professional football players develop an increased pain tolerance. People who experience chronic pains, and this is what they're saying, they experience an increased pain tolerance. And I didn't know why. I thought maybe it was just that they get used to that sensation. And you look and you see if your arm's still attached, you'll probably be okay and you don't worry about it. But the other thing is they may, through the course, and this has got to be the next study, is you look at professional football players and ask, do they have more opiate receptors in their brain? Do they have more receptors for their body's own painkilling chemicals than people like myself who sit in a desk much of the day? It's a question I've got. This research says that chronic pain may actually have some beneficial effects long-term for acute pain. Makes me feel better next time I stub my toe.
Stub your toe.
Thank goodness I am preparing myself.
You're
going to
keep a bunch of
next.
Ice thaws in case you stub your toe. You couldn't even put your toe in a bucket of ice, could you?
I could do that, but
your
I don't
whole
think
foot.
I could
Take your
bathe.
Whole foot and put it in a cooler.
Yeah, I don't think I could bathe in a bucket of ice. Well, I have ice stuffed down.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, there have been times, as you know, I've got farm ponds. I've broken through the ice there.
Have
been cold. That's not the issue. The issue is, would I willingly jump into a tub full of ice like Peyton Manning did? Do I have the ability to do that? And the answer is no. I can't tolerate that kind of cold. I don't think very long at all.
Mm.
He is a tougher guy than I am. I just say it.
Okay. He's well paid.
Yeah, but if you win the lottery, it doesn't make you able to tolerate pain better.
Yeah, but if I won the lottery, I don't need to do it for money.
So you're saying right now you just pay people enough and they'll go out and tolerate pain.
I mean, I don't think
that's so. I believe that you have a tolerance and that no matter how you wish that you could tolerate pain, in fact, you can't.
Well, maybe you're right. Maybe to some extent, especially in the case of a professional athlete, they may be, who's to say they didn't become a professional athlete because of their tolerance?
That's the problem
pain.
In it.
But
the cart and the horse.
You just never know.
My problem is, I guess there are big, very fast, very physically fit people who have a very low pain tolerance, and therefore that's why they're not a professional athlete.
Right.
All I know is that apparently if you can jump a certain height, if you can run at a certain speed, if you can throw something a certain distance, it appears that you are most likely gifted with a fairly high pain tolerance as well. And so I just don't see those people that could have been professional athletes except they couldn't handle the pain. But maybe if you can't handle pain, you can't become that athletic. You can't run that fast. You can't lift the weights to make you that strong because it hurts to run fast and lift weights. I don't know. But again, cart and horse is a big question with professional athletes. But in this case, they took ordinary people who developed arthritis, had no choice about it, and were not necessarily selected for any other characteristic. They had more opiate receptors. They could tolerate that heater probe thing a little bit longer than people who didn't have chronic pain. Interesting study. Really makes you think about that, I think. Next up, supplements. Dietary supplements. New England Journal of Medicine, October 15th. It hit all the press, but I just wanted to say something about it. In 1994, and Senator Orrin Hatch, this was out of Utah, made a change in the FDA regulations and sponsored this through. Now, Utah is basically where most dietary supplements are produced, in a small area of Utah. A multi-billion dollar, let's see, in 1994... Before this change took effect, there were 4,000 different supplements sold in the U.S. Now there, in 2012, there were 55,000. So clearly, removing these supplements from FDA oversight resulted in a change from 4,000 to 55,000. Maybe it would have happened anyway, but I don't think so. $14.8 billion of supplements being sold in the U.S. That was back in 2007. More than that now. So the New England Journal of Medicine, they just did a study. They said, how many times do people wind up in the emergency room due to supplements? Now, the FDA right now, the only thing they can do, the companies themselves are supposed to prove their supplements are safe.
Right.
Well, you can imagine that. That's
ours is safe.
Yeah. Health Matters is safe. We proved it.
Absolutely. We do it every week.
Extensive tests, and the best we can tell, it's probably safe.
No, not probably. It is.
I guess so. If the FDA demonstrates the supplement is unsafe, it can restrict its use. And actually, they've done that for over 200 dietary supplements recalled over the past about 8 years. But they warned about something called Reload. It was a supplement sold for sexual enhancement because it had Viagra. And this was back in 2013. They said, this thing says it's an herbal supplement. It is actually laced with Viagra. You get it on the internet, and you, in fact, are taking Viagra with all the side effects of Viagra. Why do I mention this? Because Lamar Odom was taking multiple doses of Reload, which, in fact, was a supplement, but it did contain the drug Viagra, and Viagra can lower your blood pressure and can cause you to pass out when combined with other medicines. So, I had not heard that until I read this summary of that article. At any rate, back to the...
topics at hand?
Yes. Back to the study. The study, 63 hospitals, 3,700 emergency department visits attributed to the use of herbal or other nutritional products, botanicals, microbial additives, and so forth. They did not actually include energy drinks. Energy drinks were excluded from this. So even though energy drinks were excluded, they still calculate an average of 23,000 Americans every year come to the emergency room due to supplements. 2,000 hospitalized every year. 25% of those due to weight loss products, 10% due to energy products other than energy drinks. Most common problem, heart palpitations, chest pain, rapid heart rate. That's about 42% of the people taking weight loss supplements, 46% of those in the emergency room taking energy products. Now, that's less than 5% of the numbers for pharmaceutical prescription products. So, dietary products are, as a group, safer than prescription products. But, dietary supplements are not regulated because they're presumed to be safe because the company says so.
Because we said so.
Yeah. And the prescription products, they actually will pull them off the market. The FDA still regulates them. The interesting thing then is a non-FDA regulated product can put 23,000 Americans every year in the emergency room. That is discouraging. And there has been an outcry about these supplements. They should be regulated. In fact, again, the Utah supplement business, their lobby, yielded undue influence and managed to get the FDA to bar the FDA from regulating these supplementary products. And unfortunately, that has allowed some of the problems that we see with people visiting the emergency room. Be wary of these things. Do not assume that because it's a supplement, because it's sold over the counter, that it will be safe. In fact, there is really no one watching right now these supplements, and they are exacting a price on Americans, just as prescriptions are. We have no love of prescription drugs here, but we also know that dietary supplements are not necessarily safe just because the FDA doesn't regulate them.
Speaking of drugs,
Rick, I'm going to do a reminder, a summary of what has been happening with drugs. This is a very discouraging trend. We talked about it last time. Turing Pharmaceuticals, Martin Shkreli, they bought up a company that made a generic drug, Daraprim, an excellent drug. It is a World Health Organization necessary drug. They changed the price on it from $13 a pill to close to $900 a pill. There was a public outcry. They said, well, we will drop the price. But again, we checked about a month ago. Other organizations checked about a month ago, and they had not yet. Federal prosecutors investigating the Canadian drug maker Valeant Pharmaceuticals in February, they brought Nitroprusse, which is a very old generic heart drug, and Isuprel, and they raised the prices by 500% on the Nitroprusse. And I've had my patients say nitroglycerin now, much more expensive. The stuff that you put under your tongue when you have chest pain, much more expensive, used to sell for pennies, and now substantially more. And you know, we've talked also about Gilead Sciences. That was their hepatitis C treatment, Sovaldi, $84,000 a course. Drug in general, Health Affairs, which is a journal, published an article in August. As far as we can tell from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, drug costs increased 12.6% in 2014. That's way beyond any other medical expenses. Matter of fact, if you look for the year, let's take 2015, overall healthcare prices went up 1.2%. Hospital care went up 1%. Physician and clinical outpatient services went down 1%. Drug prices went up nearly 5%.
Wow.
Yeah. And we've talked about the strategy. The strategy here is everyone has insurance. Everyone's insurance, most insurances cover medications. So these companies are trying to bleed the medical benefits of your insurance plan. They will not charge an individual, particularly a poor person. They will not charge them large sums of money. They have all sorts of patients assistance programs to make sure that no one individual can't afford their medicines, but that collectively they are ensuring that, in fact, we can no longer afford our medications because they're going to bleed the insurance dry. This is a very unfortunate strategy. I believe taking advantage again of the Affordable Care Act and of expansion of insurance. There was an article in Forbes about how this is business forces at work. Mm-hmm. If you can get that price, fine. Someone else will come and make a cheaper drug. The problem is this is not a normal market. These are not optional treatments for people, and they are not paying out of pocket and able to make intelligent choices like they would, say, with a ticket to a baseball game or buying a new car. There are no options for personal with hepatitis except to take these, and with the insurance companies putting most of the bill, we collectively are on the hook for these medicines.
Yeah, it's a situation that's only going to get worse until we figure out how to deal with it.
October 13th, Reuters News pointed out that the U.S. prices for 20 top-selling medicines are three times higher than those in Britain. And one of the reasons is specifically our Medicare programs cannot bargain and try to bring down the prices of medications. We pay top prices. We fund pharmaceutical companies. We subsidize the world's pharmaceutical bills with our extraordinarily high prices for our medicines. U.S. is slower to see the arrival of generic competition. One of the reasons is the brand names can often pay the other companies off and slow down the arrival of generics. Price differential slightly smaller for some more complex drugs, but the biggest difference are actually the older drugs. And in the U.S., we're raising our prices every year. And this is not just a matter, I mean, Turing Pharmaceuticals and Daraprim are an example, but there are lots of people doing this. You know, the pill that I mentioned, $13.50 to over $900, it's 66 cents in the United Kingdom. Still.
Ouch.
$900, 66 cents. You tell me, if you have a protozoan infection or malaria infection.
I don't have time to get mad here.
That's true. I've been spouting off.
Trust me, listeners, I'm upset.
Rick is watching the clock, and it is time to get us off the air. We will let you be mad in our absence.
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Hunter Reese and to Eric Bilby, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or just visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast Day, hey, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
the American Academy of Pediatrics has issued a recommendation that the minimum age to listen to Health Matters should be 21. Pediatric providers should screen patients for Health Matters listening, and those who listen should be referred for counseling.
Health Matters, very similar to e-cigarettes, should not be used to treat tobacco dependence. The benefits of Health Matters, or e-cigarettes, on smoking are not supported by scientific evidence.
Children should be kept away from Health Matters.
And e-cigarettes.
Including secondhand exposure, which happens during close contact to Health Matters listeners.
Whatever you you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make yourself funky, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week as we put it all together. What happens when tall people can't hear their diabetic dog due to their deafness? On Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.